Good afternoon. It's Monday, the 16th of July, 2018, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson. And joining me via video link from the United States is Patrick Henningsen. Welcome to the program, Patrick.
Good to be with you, Mike.
Okay, good stuff. Now, I'm just going to get straight on then with Trump, who has arrived in Helsinki last night, but he was meeting the Finnish president this morning, having a fine old time. However, it seems that President Putin decided that maybe a little bit of a delay would be in order, so he arrived late, and as a result, they met about an hour late. The original idea was that they would be both sitting down for an hour-long one-to-one meeting with just their interpreters alongside, and then a working lunch with broader staff taking part in that one, and then a press conference to be held later on. So with the delays this morning, I think they were all running about an hour late. I'm not sure whether or what that schedule, how that schedule will change. Trump, in his press conference, said that the Russians did particularly well with the World Cup. He said it was the best one ever. And he said that we, as in the US and Russia, have not been getting on very well. It's getting close to 2 years. Getting along with Russia is a good thing, not a bad thing. And so he hoped that they would discuss a wide range of topics and that they would perhaps do something about their nuclear arsenals. But Patrick, it is increasingly clear that it's pretty difficult for Trump to come away with anything here that isn't just going to be ripped to shreds by the usual suspects.
Yes, indeed. I think this is what we said a couple of weeks ago when asked about the prospect of this meeting, I think on Crosstalk on RT. And I said, no matter what Trump does and how this goes, he's going to be maligned by the U.S. press, by the mainstream media in the U.S. There's no getting around that. So the only really chance that this U.S. president has is to basically spring the trap. And this is what he's done. This is what's happening. So he's gonna get it no matter what from the U.S. press. But he has an opportunity to go over the head of the press and go, you know, directly to the global public, as it were. His base in the U.S. they're going to support what he's doing no matter what, and his critics are going to attack him no matter what. But there's a chance, at least globally. If some of this fizzles out or burns out, that globally the United States can be seen at least to make some positive overtures towards Russia, no matter how many conspiracy theories are being pumped out by the establishment press and the political establishment in Washington.
Well, let's talk about the political establishment in Washington slightly, because here's Nancy Pelosi tweeting out yesterday. This would have been Friday or Saturday. Donald Trump must immediately cancel his meeting with Putin. And this getting a typical standard response on Twitter, you know, what are you people afraid of? What is so scary about the fact that Trump is meeting Putin? So the U.S. political establishment, at least on the Democratic side, hysterical, as we were talking about on 21 Wire last night. What's the response been like on the Republican side so far?
The Republican side, a lot of people on the Republican side will sort of stand back in a neutral way. They'll support the president. I mean, a lot of people who formerly were never Trumpers have now sort of lined up behind the president, like Lindsey Graham from South Carolina, for instance, generally supports Donald Trump now, even though before he was with John McCain as a never-Trumper during the campaign and sort of during the first few months of the Trump's first term. So we'll see. I mean, but it's the Democratic opposition which dominates all the major networks, which is CNN, MSNBC, and right the way across the print or the establishment newspapers like the Washington Post, the New York Times, the LA Times, etc. So that's what you're going to see dominating, and has been dominating from this morning, right the way through the news cycle today, and probably through tomorrow as well. And there'll be sort of these crisis meetings on CNN, these roundtable discussions about, well, what are we going to do now? President is meeting with the enemy. And so the fact that the Democratic House leader, or someone like of the stature of Nancy Pelosi, would sort of demand that the U.S. have no diplomatic relations with a major U.N. Security Council partner, a nuclear power, a major geopolitical player like Russia, it says a lot. And I think that's really what's behind all the kind of fabricated reports that are being floated out, or the phantom indictments by the DOJ, and so forth. It's really about keeping relations between the U.S. and Russia on ice. You wouldn't even have seen this, Mike, during the Cold War. This level of hysteria and irrational sort of behavior, and just complete lunacy by the political establishment. I mean, it's incredible. I mean, even though we're used to seeing it over the last two years, it's still incredible to watch.
Yeah. In the meantime, what has Putin's spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, been saying? He's been speaking to Russia today.
Yeah, this is a really interesting interview. So in the run-up to this face-to-face meeting between Putin and Trump, Peskov really kind of shows what I would call Russian realism there. What he's saying is that we're under no delusions as to how this is going to be received by the U.S. establishment, by the British press, and some of the anti-Russian elements in the West. We know that Trump is under a lot of pressure to conform to an anti-Russian narrative, to sort of adopt a more hysterical, irrational approach towards international relations with Russia. So they're fully aware of that. They know that Trump is molded, is shaped by political forces in this way, and so that he's going to retain some of this position for his own national interests, because let's face it, even though being on war footing or having really poor relations with Russia isn't really in the U.S. national interest, it is part of the political reality of the United States today. That's, you can't get around this. Russia's totally aware of this. They've already priced this in to their interactions with the United States. So that shows you there's a different level of maturity there. And you look, you juxtapose these comments with some of the crazy things that are going through MSNBC and CNN and some of the other networks right now. It's quite a stark contrast.
So if anybody wants to find that, it's Putin puts Russia's interests first and respects Trump's reciprocal beliefs on RT. But RT followed up with more comments from Peskov in this one. Nord Stream 2 is an international project, and any threat against it is a concern. So what was Peskov saying? He said, let's not forget that Nord Stream 2 is an international project, not simply a Russian one or a Russian-German one. This joint project has several participants, big companies from various nations, certainly threatening those shareholders or threatening Russia and Germany with sanctions in response to the progress of the project is very concerning. He said, that our ties are currently in a deplorable state, and that Russia wasn't the one to initiate such a collapse of the whole system of our relations. Clearly Trump's comments at the NATO conference last week, heading home with the Russians, but they're certainly, they may be making comments like this, but they're pragmatic about it as well.
Sure. This is a really important point, actually. The Nord Stream 2 project, this is kind of central to this whole discussion. So you're talking about a major energy project, joint venture with multiple parties, multiple countries, corporations involved. The two biggest partners in this project, you could say, are Germany and Russia. So German companies are partnering with Gazprom, the major Russian gas provider, to build a pipeline. So essentially what this is a bypass of the Ukrainian pipeline along the northern route to supply Europe directly with gas. And so this is totally upsetting the United States, obviously, because the U.S. sponsored, engineered and sponsored a coup in Kiev in 2014. And this has also disrupted or played a little bit of a supply game with, as the Ukraine was the middleman really between Russia and Europe in terms of delivering Russian gas. And at that time, the Ukraine owed back payments, significant back payments in the billions of dollars to Russia in terms of its gas bill. And Russia had already subsidized cut rate prices for the Ukraine, but so the U.S. used this when they were sort of puppeteering the new government in Kiev, were using this gas debt and using this poor record of relations between Russia and Ukraine as sort of bargaining chip back and forth. So for Germany, they can't afford to not have a steady supply of energy. You have to remember, the European Union, we spoke about this on the Sunday Wire last night. The European Union is the largest common market in the world. So when you have an economic machine of this size, it needs energy security. It needs a steady supply of natural gas, in this case, and oil and other forms of energy, which it gets from different partners. But in terms of Germany being the economic powerhouse of the EU, it needs energy security. The United States is not going to supply Germany with energy security. Russia is going to be its regional partner to guarantee that. And if you look back in history, this exact same situation or very similar situation took place in the early 1980s when Ronald Reagan was president. And at that time, the Soviet Union was proposing a pipeline from Siberia to West Germany and to connecting into other major hubs in Western Europe. And the United States opposed this vehemently. This is almost like a repeat of the Siberian pipeline scenario. And what Reagan did was then threatened sanctions against European companies involved in that project, exactly what we're seeing the threats being made here. And guess what happened in the end? You know, this required the governments of Germany and France, et cetera, to acquiesce to Ronald Reagan's demands at that time. And what did they do? Those governments did not. They backed their companies. And they said, we're going to back you. And they basically told Washington where they could go on this issue. And so guess what? That effort collapsed by the United States. They weren't able to enforce that. So they're not going to be able to enforce an economic statecraft attack on Germany, for instance, over the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. It's ridiculous. So, you know, the United States thinks it can throw a bunch of bottled LNG onto a tanker and, you know, ship it from the U.S. East Coast to Germany and load them up with expensive LNG that costs twice, three, four times the price to ship subsidized LNG, in some cases, liquefied natural gas, and that somehow that's going to power the baseload electrical requirements that Germany needs every morning to light up this country. No way. Where they're going to get that energy is from Russia. And as you pointed out as well yesterday, Germany has powered down a number of its nuclear power plants in recent years.
In fact, it's going to remove all nuclear capability, its civilian nuclear power generation by, I believe it's 2022 at the latest. So Germany will have no alternative but either renewables or gas.
Yeah, so Mike, it's a fait accompli. And so I don't know what Donald Trump or anyone in the U.S. is going to benefit from kicking up a fuss about the Nord Stream 2 pipeline project. And by the way, the South Stream pipeline project is not completely dead now either. So the political climate has shifted and changed significantly since the winter of 2014. The Turk Stream pipeline project between Russia and Turkey, I mean, you have to look at their relations were at all-time low after Turkey shot down a Russian fighter jet in the fall of 2015. And since then, Russia has rebuilt its relations with Turkey. They're cooperating on the Astana process. So it's not a perfect relationship, but it's certainly improving. They've resumed work on the TurkStream pipeline. That can conceivably run gas into southern Europe. But the South Stream pipeline itself could go ahead. Bulgaria and some Eastern European countries may eventually fully resolve all of their disputes. What the European Union had in terms of blockage on the South Stream pipeline issue, those eventually will be overcome. So this project, depending on who you're talking to, it's still alive as well. So, you know, that's energy security for the EU. And there's nothing the US can do about it. It's just a fact of life.
Okay, well, we were talking a few minutes ago about what is going on in the US or what the type of responses from the political establishment to try to undermine this Trump-Putin summit today. In the UK, of course, we have had Novichok 2, the sequel, over the last couple of weeks. Well, this has now got to a point because on Friday evening, the Metropolitan Police released a press release saying that they discovered the source of the Novichok in the latest Novichok poisoning situation in Amesbury. And they produced a press release on that. Today, the UK government has announced that it has invited the OPCW to travel to the UK early next week to quotes, independently confirm the identity of the nerve agent, which has resulted in the death of one British national in Amesbury and has left another in a serious condition in hospital. Peter Wilson, UK representative of the Organisation for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, has written to the organisation's Director General, inviting him to assist in accordance with Article 38E of the Chemical Weapons Convention. So that is now a formal request, Patrick. But of course, you know, this issue is being used to demonize Russia. And you've got to wonder, bearing in mind everything you've just said about energy security and the requirement, particularly for Germany to be receiving energy from Russia, how this narrative, which Britain is trying to pursue very strongly, that Russia is the enemy and that effectively we are at risk of ending up in a war with Russia, how that fits with the reality of Germany's position here.
Yeah, the OPCW issue, as we both know, and as everybody kind of who's following this story knows, the timing of this second Novichok narrative, which has been pushed out, well timed with the semifinals of the Russian World Cup, but also timed with the announcement that the OPCW would be given powers to assign blame. So in other words, judge, jury, and executioner, this group of chemical weapons NGO based out of The Hague and in the Netherlands can all of a sudden have judiciary power and in terms of deciding who's to blame for a supposed chemical weapons attack. So this is all kind of coming to a kind of perfect storm right now. And I think it has more, it's not just to do with the energy security issue, which I don't think that's an immovable object in my opinion. But maybe more so, Mike, to do with two things. One is NATO, and the sort of the general, defense, effort, in terms of, defense spending. That's one aspect. I think that's, certainly driving the motivation to sort of ramp up the Russian threat narrative from the UK, certainly all the players in the defense industry like this tension, which is being ramped up. This is definitely good for all of these powerful corporations. But more than that, I think it's intrinsically connected, Mike, with Syria because of what's happening there in terms of getting a foot leverage or traction on the issue of sort of continuing to isolate Russia and its allies in the Middle East, and those include Syria and of course Iran as well. So this is still a major issue. I it looks like the United States is completely losing traction on so many fronts in Syria, as are the UK, its partner. But that doesn't mean they're going to stop fighting and trying to continue to create problems by the nature of their military occupation in parts of Syria along the Syrian-Iraqi border. So I think in terms of the whole chemical weapons narrative, they still have to justify previous claims of chemical weapons use. So they, even though Douma, the attack from Douma is in the rearview mirror, they still have to shore up that narrative. They can't afford to let go of that and allow that to sort of disintegrate. That's still a major. So in other words, they're having to retroactively shore up a lot of these very shaky historical events, which foreign policy has been built on top of. And those include Douma, that's Khan Shehun the year before, that's Eastern Ghouta in August 2013. I mean, if you look at the whole U.S., the Anglo-American foreign policy pyramid that's been constructed is really on the basis of all these chemical attacks. It's a house of cards. And so in that way, Mike, I would say that the Skripal parts 1 and 2 are also help to reinforce that house of cards going forward. I mean, it's if you look at it from what it truly is, there's little or no evidence to support any of these claims. And they're as dubious as you can get in terms of international incidents. But the establishment needs to keep going. They need to double down. They need to keep shoring up these narratives going forward. It's going to become harder and harder. It's going to become a lot tougher.
Well, indeed. And I believe that on Thursday night or Friday, Jeremy Hunt was on Fox News in the U.S. where he again reiterated the claim that the Russians had killed. This is the language they used, that the Russians had killed a British citizen on British soil. No evidence for that whatsoever. Look, we've got to move on. Let's go to Brexit. And Justine Greening, the former education secretary, coming out today, intervening in the whole Brexit charade, claiming that we now need a second referendum. So this is now somebody on the Tory side claiming a second referendum on this whole thing. Now, this comes as they are intending to debate the new customs bill in the House of Commons today, and the Democratic Unionist Party, well, let's just bring the BBC in here for a bit of fun. The Democratic Unionist Party, who, of course, having received their £1.2 billion bung to shore up Theresa May's government, are now looking to get a legal guarantee. So they've had multiple assurances from the British government that there will be no hard border between Northern Ireland and the rest of the United Kingdom. They're now looking for that to be enshrined in law, perhaps in this customs bill. Whether the government is prepared to go that far, I don't know. But of course, if they withdraw their support from Theresa May on this basis, then effectively her government can't survive. So it's looking like things getting pretty tricky for her at the moment. We've said from the beginning, Patrick, that this whole thing was a charade, and various people saying that they could end up at the end of the day with a situation where half the Tory party can't agree on the Brexit deal that she has presented, and the other half can't agree on leaving with no deal. So it's it's pretty hard to see how she can actually move forward from this point.
Yeah, there's a bit of a minefield there, Mike. And I think we had mentioned this in previous analysis on this issue, that indeed Brexit, or the scarpering of Brexit, even though structurally it's been a very weak effort from the very beginning, in fact, but the actual sort of derailment of this, the official derailment, could come down to some minor detail or relatively sort of smaller event, or like the hard border issue in Ireland. So and sometimes these types of situations, they always do come down to smaller details like this issue. So one could look at this, Mike, and say, well, that's easily resolvable if we do X, Y, and Z. It's certainly something that can be overcome. It's not a It's not an issue that both countries don't have any experience with over the years, don't have any knowledge of. So it, certainly it's resolvable, but that in sort of giving an putting an official reason on the failure of Brexit, it would certainly be nice and convenient to blame it on a person or something, an issue like something we just can't overcome, and that could be the Northern Irish border issue.
Yeah, I believe that's exactly right. It's an insurmountable problem. Patrick, from the very beginning, I've been trying to keep the original David Cameron white paper, The Best of Both Worlds, in people's minds. I keep mentioning it because it's a key document if you want to understand the timeline of what's happened in the last 2 years. But Justine Greening, in fact, reminded everybody of that herself, where she said that this situation we're in at the moment is the worst of all worlds. So she was clearly sort of harking back to that original document. And that's, I think, the second or third time we've seen people mentioning that in the last couple of days. So hopefully that is that point is being appreciated. Now, let's move on to is this good news? Because the British government has announced a new spaceport, apparently, for the United Kingdom. One giant leap, they say, vertical launch spaceport to bring UK into new space age. The UK is set to build on its world-leading expertise in aerospace with the development of vertical and horizontal spaceports. The industry strategy funding awarded to proposed vertical launch spaceport in Sutherland in Scotland. So, that's fantastic. They've got a nice little explanatory video on the website and so on, so you can go and have a look at that if you wish. And then in parallel with that, we discovered that Lockheed Martin has been given a whole wedge of money in order to come and produce some rockets to actually launch from this vertical spaceport. They've been given UK Space Agency grants totaling £23.5 million, with a further £5.5 million going to a British company called Orbex to build some of the rocket technology for this. So this builds on awards of £2.5 million to the Highlands and Islands Enterprise to develop this spaceport. Well, this is amazing because actually Britain had the capability to launch satellites in the 1960s and the 1970s through Blue Streak originally, that was cancelled. And then through Black Arrow, and unfortunately that was cancelled as well. Of course, both these projects were cancelled on the basis of Britain attempting to enter the European Union. So here we are now, a few decades later, and we're now paying a private company to try to redevelop the technology that we had in the 60s and the 70s. And it should be noted, Patrick, that Britain, as of this year, up until now, Britain is the only country on the planet to have successfully developed and then cancelled a satellite launch capability. Every other country on the planet to have developed a satellite launch capability has either retained it through their own space programs or they have, in the case of France, they've rolled it into the European space program. But nonetheless, it's not lost to them as a nation. But apparently, not only are we going to throw away pots of money on the F-35 to Lockheed Martin, but we're now bringing Lockheed Martin in to try to recover some technology that we already had. Quite amazing.
I think how can you not look at this announcement or this nice fancy video and animation as being sort of part of a symbolic announcement to sort of somehow make it seem like this could be a benefit of Brexit? I don't know. Certainly this is looks like a PR exercise by the government, Mike, but I'm sort of going to remind people just briefly that, you know, to build a rocket program, a viable sort of space program, this takes decades of work. This is through universities, research, testing. This takes decades. The United States doesn't even have a fully formed operational rocket program. Consider that. Where has the U.S. been buying and getting its rockets from for the last few decades? Well, they're getting it from Russia and the former Soviet republics. So they have a viable space program. So they're supplying the United States with booster rockets to take its astronauts up to the International Space Station. So I just think, Mike, how long is it going to take to develop this? And this isn't something. This isn't like developing a car. This is much more difficult, much more expensive, and it takes a lot longer, I think. And there's a lot more risk involved, actually, because there's no room for failure. If you want to talk about national pride, then, you know, it's, I don't think any incident or accident, this space program would have trouble overcoming, if there were anything unfortunate happen. This is why you tend to go with a sure thing. And Russia has that sure thing. China has a really well developed space program as well. So they're decades ahead, Mike. I don't know. Britain will be really starting from the back. And what's the point? Is it worth the money in terms of building national pride?
There can be no national pride in this, Patrick, because it's Lockheed Martin's project at the end of the day. We're simply throwing money at a globalist private company. There's no national pride in this, I don't think.
But the cartoon looked really good, though. So yes. I don't know, Mike. The CGI graphics were beautiful. I mean, they're really inspirational. And to see the Scottish Highlands being polluted there by a massive burst of toxic fuel there across the beautiful untouched wilderness, it's inspirational. You have to admit, Mike, it really is.
Well, it's just as well that they're only talking about satellites and not putting any humans into space, bearing in mind Lockheed Martin's oxygen problems with the F-35. Let's put it that way. Now, yeah, you mentioned China, and of course they do have a burgeoning space program at the moment. But more anti-Chinese rhetoric from U.S. Establishment here in the Financial Times. Globalized business is a U.S. security issue.
So this is interesting. So we'll see how far this goes in terms of. This is the Financial Times has floated this out. This is kind of more of a positional piece, a sort of short article, but it's kind of a firing out a little salvo there as they're going to sort of start politicizing as the potential trade wars start ramping up between the U.S. and China. And this is a very real issue, Mike. China will probably launch some sort of legal action in the World Trade Organization. It'll launch a WTO action against the U.S., over tariff threats. So you're talking about China and the U.S. Going at it in a world sort of legal challenge. And so China will be possibly looking for damages in this if it feels or if the WTO decides that the U.S. is in violation of sort of basic norms in terms of trade. So the Financial Times is then sort of jockeying for position on this issue, on this article. So it is very interesting that to see the financial press kind of working on the fringes of this issue. And so we could see this in terms of positioning China as if Russia isn't going to fit the bill for the real global rival for the U.S., for the West, will China do it? Is this going to be an economic fear mongering by the Western press? Is this how it's going to go? At least in the short term, we'll see.
Indeed, and I'll just put it back up on screen in a second, because you've delivered a balanced, rational explanation of what's going on here, unlike the language being used in the article itself. So just before we leave this, I just want to mention that, because the first paragraph here says, when Donald Trump upsets free market liberals with new tariffs, the U.S. president's critics tend to pin the blame on him alone. Trump's trade war, as the shorthand goes, is either a negotiating position or the latest manifestation of what many see as a full-blown personality disorder. That's quite strong, really, isn't it? Just briefly.
Yeah. Well, you're right. I think it is correct to look at these trade threats as a kind of a Trump positioning for a better deal for the United States. I don't think the Chinese are naive either to know that's what's happening. The same goes, Mike, for foreign policy. The North Koreans are totally understand this is the style of this president. I think it's becoming, people are getting used to this is how hardball negotiations are going to be done with the United States on all these issues. So it's funny that the press haven't the press haven't come to that realization completely, although the rest of the political leaders around the world, any of them who are smart anyway, will have already come to that conclusion.
Okay, here is Yuri Fedotov on screen at the moment. He's executive director of the UNODC, the UN Drugs Control Organization. Now, he was speaking at the OSCE, that's the Organization of Security Cooperation in Europe, anti-drugs conference this morning. And he said, he said this, opium production worldwide has reached highest ever recorded by UNODC. Well, this follows on from the 2018 UN World Drug Report, which was published about 4 weeks ago now. What is it showing? If we look at the opium details, the opium poppy cultivation and production of opium 2006 to 2017, we can see that he's absolutely right. We've got the highest level ever recorded on the right-hand side there. And where is the production coming from? Well, of course, Afghanistan. Now, this is an issue that we've been discussing many, many times on this program, Patrick, particularly because, of course, what had happened in 2001, just prior to us intervening in that country, the UK and the United States, was that the Taliban had effectively shut down opium production. Now, of course, things have changed in the last 18 years. Now it is mainly the Taliban that's driving this opium production, because, of course, that's what they're using to fund their activities now. But this is a situation which has been engineered by the UK and the United States, who, if we remember, during the period of the occupation in Helmand province, for example, which is where the main opium production area, the UK was absolutely promoting opium production, opium farmers. They were distributing leaflets at that time saying, we understand that you really don't have any choice but to use this as your cash crop. So they have encouraged this situation. And now we're in the situation that effectively opium production in Afghanistan is controlled by the people that apparently we went into Afghanistan in the first place to control and to destroy their infrastructure. So hasn't really been the most successful operation, or has it?
Yeah, I mean, I think you got to look at this in a commodity, from a commodity point of view, and supply and demand. So what that chart tells you that you just shown, Mike, is that the supply has been creeping up and is stabilized at high levels globally. And so who are the biggest beneficiaries in terms of consumption and sales of, let's say, heroin? It's going to be the more wealthy Western countries. I think it's extraordinary that in the 1990s, in late 1990s, and the price of heroin on the street gotten so high, Mike, that it was not the sort of, wasn't as fashionable or the drug of choice for drug users. And then all of a sudden, post 9/11, the global market, especially in the U.S. and Western Europe, is flooded with cheap heroin. And so what's going to happen? That's going to stimulate use in the market. That's a pretty easy equation to understand. Now let's look at Afghanistan. This year has been one of the biggest years of violence in Afghanistan, despite the so-called ceasefire. The UN's reporting a record high civilian death tolls in Afghanistan. How many years later are we since the U.S. first invaded and occupied under the NATO banner Afghanistan? So it's been like 17 years now. And so we have record-breaking civilian deaths this year. On both fronts, on the drug front, it's a bad picture. But also on the actual Afghanistan front, it's not much of an improvement either. I'm not going to say that the Taliban they did allow opium production for a number of years, but they did clamp down on it in 2000, 1999 and 2000. And all of a sudden, during the occupation, a lot of that has stopped. So there's definitely a correlation there. There are exposés about actual military involvement, and then you have blue and green violence as well in Afghanistan, and you have it's definitely an issue that it should deserve a lot more attention in terms of law enforcement. You know, what are military's roles in guaranteeing the supply of opium from Afghanistan? Is anyone involved in the transportation of not just opium, Mike, but Afghanistan was one of the biggest suppliers of cannabis to the market and to the illegal market as well. Number one supplier for a number of years. I don't know if they're still number one, but they were number one for a while. So on all fronts, all drug production in Afghanistan has skyrocketed after the U.S. Occupation.
Yes, okay, good. Thank you, Patrick. Now let's move on to Syria. And Vanessa Bailey pushing this out today. First batch of terrorists evacuated along with their families from Daraa to northern Syria. White helmets very likely included. So there are the buses there. But Patrick, this article in CNN is pretty... well, what is the word I could use? The headline is U.S. and allies are discussing evacuating rescue group from Syria. So this is the White Helmets, who you and Vanessa and us, to a certain degree, have been really trying to make the point that this group is directly linked to terrorists in Syria. And now we're talking, according to CNN here, now we're talking about actually bringing these people into the UK and into the United States. That's a pretty concerning development.
Yeah, I don't think they have much choice, Mike, but to sort of create this kind of fluffy story about evacuating these rescuers and heroes from the evil clutches of Bashar al-Assad in Syria. And so CNN claiming that there's, you know, 1,000 volunteers and their family members who need to be evacuated and airlifted to safety in the U.S., in the U.K., in France, in Canada. And it's quite extraordinary. Like there are really 1,000 white helmets saving lives left in Syria running around. So all they've done is make videos that have supplied people like CNN with all of their headline news on Syria for the last, since late 2013. That's what the White Helmets have been doing. So I think they have no choice but to do this as well, because, you know, you have to remember, if any of these White Helmets ever talk to the press with a different story than the sort of official White Helmets narrative, then if you have any whistleblowers, then this thing's going to disintegrate pretty rapidly in terms of a narrative. What's left of it anyway in the mainstream that's sellable, that's going to be a huge problem. So the best way, I guess, is to bribe them with, U.S. citizenship or Western European citizenship, and that's going to sort of help solve the problem, set them up with all the perks of living in the advanced, wonderful Western civilization. So it's pretty amazing how it is being sold right now. And also, I'm surprised there wasn't more White Helmets videos released in Daraa. But right now the Syrian army is very close to liberating that entire area and eventually the entire southern front. So it's interesting the story is coming out now and they're sort of pumping it up like this.
Okay, well, we'll just point people at 21st Century Wire to Vanessa's latest article. Syria, the White Helmet Exodus, managed by Regime Change Coalition. Recommend people go and read that for more on this. But Patrick, in Syria, for the first time, Russian jets have bombed jihadists in Kunitra province, close to Israeli deployment. That was on the 15th, Well, immediately followed up, apparently, by Israel bombing Syria again. So these two these two events linked?
You could say yes, they are linked. It is interesting to see if Russia's active on the southern front in this way. But yeah, I think the overall picture, Mike, is you're seeing a rapid, it's coming to a rapid close, which is the sort of the terrorist occupation of large swaths of territory in this part of Syria. If this area is eventually cleaned up, which it looks like it's going to, that's going to mean two things. One, it's going to escalate the issue in the U.S., this kind of fake narrative that Iran is occupying Syria, and this is posing a threat to Israel. This will then be ramped up again, the Iranian threat. As soon as these southern areas are liberated of terrorists, then Israel has has a lot less leverage in sort of meddling in southern Syria, as do the U.S. and its allies. And so Jordan will also want to back off a little bit on this issue. They've been hosting terrorist training camps for years, much like Turkey has, providing safe haven for terrorists, and as Israel has as well. That's on record, even in the Israeli press. So that's what you're going to see there. But yeah, I'm a lot of people are surprised to see Russia active militarily from an airstrike point of view in the southern region right now. But that means that only two areas are going to be really left. Major areas left to liberate. One of them is going to be Idlib in the northern part of Syria, northwest or west of Aleppo. And the other area is still the U.S. occupation of northeastern Syria and this bit in the northeastern area above the Euphrates. So these will be the two remaining areas, the two remaining flashpoints. Are those going to become hard situations, protracted situations? That will be really interesting to see how that develops. But this is huge development in the southern front over the last month.
Okay, look, we're pretty much out of time here, Patrick. But just before we move on to the last article here, what do you think, just very, very briefly, what do you think the chances are that Trump might do some kind of deal with regard to the occupation in northeast Syria when he meets Putin today?
I would be surprised if any major announcements come out of this meeting with Vladimir Putin, Mike. So I'm not expecting anything. However, if the president was going to surprise the world, certainly that might be something really, really interesting to happen. I think it would be definitely welcomed by a lot of people, even in the United States, Mike. I'm not holding my breath. But I'd love to be wrong on that.
Yeah, indeed. Okay, we've got just a minute left. Patrick, I just wanted to get this one in because Robert Inlakesh was speaking on the Sunday Wire last night about the latest events in Gaza and the West Bank. So you've got an article from him just published, Why is Gaza on the Verge of War with Israel? Well, it was quite an interesting segment on the program last night.
Yes, it was, absolutely. So Robert Inlakesh, a great advocate for Palestine. He's also an independent journalist as well. I think people check this article out, check out the situation. Tensions are brewing hotter than ever right now in Gaza. So the Israel's positioned its assets right now. And we've seen this happen in July in previous years. This is the sort of the summer attack wave from the IDF against the Palestinians, supposedly to cull Hamas in this case. That will be the excuse again. So this time it's explosive kites, Mike. This is the major threat to the Israelis. Before it was tunnels, it was terrorist tunnels. So I think with all of these major incursions and campaigns of violence by the Israeli government against the native Palestinian population, there's always some sort of excuse, and that's put out in the media. And this is the next big threat, whether it's Katush or these glorified giant bottle rockets, or it's explosive kites or terrorist tunnels. There's always something. So I'm not sure what will be the final, or some kidnapping of Israelis, or that didn't happen, some excuse. So they'll need some sort of a catalyst or some event to sort of trigger this if Israel wants to go all out and make major incursions, even on the ground in Gaza.
I mean, but you can't be right, Patrick, because on the BBC Radio 4 Today program this morning, they said that Israel as a nation has a right to defend itself from explosive kites. And that you know, for example, an appropriate opposition to an explosive kite is an F-35. That's quite reasonable, isn't it? It's equity of arms there. But they were saying quite clearly that Israel was giving the Palestinians every opportunity to avoid having their children shot by firing warning shots, for example. So Israel behaving absolutely within the limits of international law, according to the BBC anyway.
Yeah, well, the BBC is not behaving within the limits of Ofcom, if that's the sort of narrative they're putting out. It's not a balanced situation. These aren't two equal sides, as Robert very intelligently laid out that case yesterday on the Sunday Wire, Mike. So if the BBC is spinning it in that way to make it seem like there's some equivocal behavior between the Israel, who's occupying illegally the parts of Palestine, according to multiple UN resolutions and international agreements, and somehow framing this as these are two sides that are equally responsible for the situation, that itself is just pure propaganda.
Yeah.
And that's kind of shameful that the BBC is engaged in that level of spin and propaganda. It should be shocking to everybody.
Absolutely. Okay, well, look, we're going to leave it there. We're a bit over time. Thank you very much for joining me today, Patrick. Been a pleasure as always. You're back in the UK this week, is that right?
Yeah, well, hopefully I'll see you next week, Mike.
Yeah, fantastic. Okay, thank you very much for joining us today. We will be back at the same time tomorrow. If you like what we're doing, please consider taking out a subscription or making a donation, because we can only do this with your help. Thank you very much, and we will be back at the same time tomorrow. See you then. Bye-bye.